Hey everybody, Stu Smith here, and we have another Two Through and After series podcast for you. And we got special guest Kaz Larson, who is a former Navy SEAL and has been doing some incredible things after his SEAL career, which we will get to talking about. But Kaz, welcome. Welcome, and thanks for being a part of this, giving your time. We tried to do this, I think, probably a year ago, and you've always been off busy and stuff, but hey, you're home now like all of us. So we're going to take advantage of this coronavirus shelter in place and get stuff done.
Yeah, well, you know, you taught me well. Never let a good crisis go to waste. We're gonna make some mileage here.
I'm still working. I'm still working. Right. So anyway, the way this works is we ask you just a few series of questions, and it's really mainly about your journey. You know, so Kaz, first question is, you know, who were you before you decided to join the military? Where'd you grow up? Tell me about your family and hobbies and sports, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess first off, I'd say, like, it's an honor to be here, Stu. I would not be sitting here with a shadow box, with a trident on the wall, and with all of the experience that I accumulated in the SEAL teams, if it wasn't for your mentorship and your tutelage. You were a fundamental influence on my life and a fundamental reason that my life has taken the course and trajectory it has. So it's a great honor.
Well, thank you very much. That was unsolicited, by the way, but I appreciate that. It's been a privilege to be part of your journey in any way. So
But in my case, I think it was even more poignant the influence you had on my life because you know, I grew up as like a skinny little surfer kid in a small town in Northern California called Santa Cruz, which is kind of known for big waves, cold water, and a lot of men in gray suits, which are what we call the sharks out there. I live about 30 minutes. It's deep in the center, the epicenter of the Red Triangle, which is one of the greatest concentrations of great white sharks in the world. I used to surf a place as a kid called Año Nuevo, which is an elephant seal rookery, breeding ground for elephant seals, which is basically like a buffet for great white sharks, right? So
yeah,
it's cold. It's sharky.
Scary.
It can be a little scary, yeah. Like, it's spooky when, like, it's rainy and you're out there by yourself and you're seeing these, like, shapes moving underneath the water and you don't know what's out there. So, yeah, that's the environment.
That sounds like me growing up in North Florida, you know, water skiing in lakes with nothing but alligators and
gators. Oh, my God. It's funny what you can get used to. Like, I'm not really that scared of sharks. Every once in a while it crosses my mind, but like, God, put me in like a stream in Florida and I'm paranoid about alligators. Put me in a bird bath and I'm thinking about alligators. So, you know, it was actually an extraordinary place to grow up. I think it's an incredible breeding ground, not just for seals, but a great breeding ground for great watermen. We have a long tradition of amazing watermen that have come out of Santa Cruz, big wave surfers, competitive lifeguards, great water polo players. And so I grew up surfing, playing water polo, just kind of a beach kid. My first day of life, my mom brought me down to the beach and kind of baptized me in the ocean there.
Nice.
And And you know, Santa Cruz is kind of a hippie community. My mom doesn't like when I say hippie, but kind of an alternative community. My mom was teaching at the university, so I actually grew up on the campus there. And but the truth is, I didn't really know. I'd never even heard of SEALs when I was growing up.
Other than what was being eaten out in the ocean,
right? That's what SEALs. These were SEALs, right? When I was growing up, you know, our community was not. You and I have talked about this a lot. Our community was not in the spotlight. It was not well known. The closest thing I knew to military and special forces was probably the Chuck Norris Delta Force movies. Back then, everybody was talking about Delta Force, right? Yeah,
Delta Force, and Green Berets. Special Forces. Yeah, Rambo.
Totally. Yeah. Yep. But you know, in my family, you know, my grandfather had served in the Navy in World War II. He was actually at Pearl Harbor during the attack. And so I did, and my father, is US Marine. He likes to clarify that he was a Paris Island Marine and, hardcore. And, And my dad's also a phenomenal athlete. So I had a tradition, a small tradition of service in my family. It was important. And then the other thing was that when I was really young, I was really privileged. My dad got me into aviation and he bought me flying lessons at like 11 years old. And I used to fly Cessna 152s sitting on telephone books for the prospective spec up candidates out there. Telephone books are these things they used to have.
About this thick.
They're about this thick. Yeah. This is an analog world. And there are these thick books that got delivered to your door that had everybody's telephone number in them. So I used to like stack them up high so I could see over the hood of the Cessna when I was flying. And, you know, like any other, like anybody else, I watched Top Gun and I thought I wanted to be a naval aviator, and I was playing water polo competitively. And Mike Schofield, who's the infamous coach at the Naval Academy, water polo legendary coach, produced a lot of Olympians and great NC2A athletes. And
a lot of SEALs came out of that program.
A lot of frogmen came out of that program. So, you know, I was recruited there. I went and played, and I applied to the academy because I wanted to fly and because of the traditions of service. And then when I arrived at the academy, I met guys like Johnny Sanchez, who was a frogman who came out a couple years after you, right? But he was kind of under your umbrella. And like so many SEALs that came through that tradition. And so I started meeting all these SEALs, including yourself, and I learned about this new community that seemed to really fit my personality better.
Yeah, that was very similar to my journey, because, I mean, my first, I guess, view of what the Naval Academy was I was recruited for sports, for football. So Army and Navy were interested in me, and I was like, huh, Army-Navy game. I was like, oh, okay, so I can go serve and I can play sports? Oh, this is just too good to be true, because I wanted to play college ball, you know, somewhere, and because I just loved it. And that's a long story too. It's not my story, but you know, I too had the same drive of serving, playing sports, but also my first, and I won't lie, my first inclination of everything was that damn Top Gun movie. You know, it is probably one of the worst movies ever. But for the 16-year-old me, I loved it.
I mean, look, I'll give you a little spoiler alert right here. Still, is that I, as you know, in the TV business, we call this foreshadowing, right? Like you give a little tease of what's to come. But you know, as you know, I ended up in media, and then last year came around that they were filming Top Gun 2 after all of that. And so, you know, I've made some friends and some connections in this town in Hollywood. And and I called up the director, a guy named Joe Kaczynski, and I said, like, look, I am cashing in a favor. You will put me in Top Gun 2. And I got myself a little cameo in Top Gun 2. And it was the greatest moment of my life. I could die happy. I mean, that movie changed my life. Joined the Navy.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I like that. So anyway, even though it is kind of corny, you know, it is what did it. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot to light that little spark, you know, or light that little flame that's in the back of your head to start driving people towards a different direction. And it might be a movie, it might be a book, it might be someone you know in your neighborhood, whatever that is, you know, listen to that little spark, and then your motivation is just off the chart. Yeah, really. Absolutely. Is. So, Absolutely. So tell us about your first few years at the Academy. How did that work out for you?
So I think my first couple of years at the Academy were fairly typical. As you know, playing a sport at the Academy is kind of essential to your mental state of being and your well-being, especially as a, you know, hippie kid from Santa Cruz. All of a sudden I was thrust into this military environment where everything was ordered and, you know, you had to wear your uniform and you didn't get civilian clothes and all this stuff. So that was actually pretty jarring for me. You know, a lot of my friends from back home were professional surfers and they were, you know, surfing the world and making magazine photos and covers. And I was like, wow, you don't know what you had until you lost it. But you know, my family was extraordinarily proud. And it's funny, you know, I'm a September baby. So I was on the kind of young end of the spectrum. I was 17 actually when I showed up for plebe summer and the Academy. And, you know, it's an interesting, as you know, It's wild. It is like you slam into a brick wall of reality when you show up as a plebe at 17 at the Naval Academy. Your life changes overnight.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you think you're pretty squared away. You know, you think you've done everything right until this point. You know, you got yourself into a very competitive program. You know, you've hit all the right wickets along your journey. And then all of a sudden you realize, holy crap, I am not as smart as I thought I was. You know, yeah. I am not as strong as, you know, I thought I was. You know, just everything, just the comparison of your classmates to you is a real shock, at least for me. Yeah. You know, it's like, do I really belong here? It took me a while to figure that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And luckily I had the camaraderie of the water polo team, an extraordinary collection of guys. I looked back at one of those photos from that, from my plebe year, my freshman year water polo. And of the like 23 guys, something like 13 of them I counted had gone spec war or EOD in some capacity. So in some ways the water polo program was a really good proving ground. Oh, yeah. To go on and serve later on. Some kind of legendary names coming out of that program.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah.
Great frogmen who are still currently doing great, great things today.
Yeah, absolutely. So you had a little bit different journey than most Academy guys, but it's not uncommon. You know, it's a lot of people make that decision. There's a special night that's halfway through your Academy journey called 2-for-7 night. And it's a big party. You sign on the dotted line that you've been there for 2 years, but you're going to owe 7 more. That means 2 more of the Academy plus 5 years of active duty service. So you decided, and there's a rule that if you don't decide to do that, you can actually get out cost-free. Like you don't owe the Navy anything. You've had 2 years of military training and education, and you went off. Where'd you go to next?
UC Santa Cruz, the Fighting Banana Slugs. So I skipped that party, the 2-for-7. I missed that party because I decided after 2 years that I wanted to take a different path. And so I headed back home to UC Santa Cruz. It's actually a pretty extraordinary school. And I had grown up on that campus. My mom had taught there. And I went back and I had a phenomenal education. That being said, the contrast between these two institutions probably could not have been greater.
I can't imagine. It must have been a shock, equal shock going back.
It was. And, you know, it was interesting when I decided to leave the Academy of my own volition. I was just thinking I wanted to take a different path. I wasn't sure about this commitment for another, you know, sort of decade of being in the military. And so when I left and then I came back and then when I was back in my hometown, I sort of had like brought all of these Naval Academy values with me, like all of that discipline and all of that work ethic and working with guys like you and training. So it was cool. I went back home, I finished school. And I think the instructive part about that piece is that there is, in hindsight, we order everything's like they were deliberate decisions. But the truth is, there's no straight line to BUDS. In fact, there's no straight line in life, right? Yeah. I took this kind of funny, interesting, circuitous path, but it's my path, and I own it, even if it's kind of an atraditional path.
Yeah, your path is the path for you.
Right.
You know, it worked for you. So, yes.
Yeah, so, I wouldn't recommend that highly to everyone, but...
Well, you know what?
To find your own way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We had a gentleman this past, a couple of years ago, did the 2-for-7, pulled chalks on 2-for-7 night, enlisted in the Navy, and is now an enlisted SEAL medic, corpsman. So, not a corpsman anymore, but he's, you know, he's went the medical route, you know.
Right.
And
Delta guy.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So. Yeah, those guys are awesome.
That's another option. Like I said, he's a smart guy, and at the end of 2 years, he was like, you know what, I think I want to be enlisted. Hey, you know, and he is, like I said, that's a way to go, not necessarily the way to go, but if it's your way to go, it is the way to go. So, that's awesome. Did you have any issues with that transition?
I did in a funny way. I guess I didn't realize how much I had absorbed from the Academy because both sort of culturally, internally, psychologically. It's hard to sometimes realize when you're in the fray and you're 17 and turning 18 at the academy, you're changing and sure. you're building who you are as a person. And what I realized over the course of the next couple of years is that my, one, my desire to serve still existed. And two, training with you and then, you know, Dick Hoffman was my company officer at the time. My squad at the Naval Academy, for those people who don't know, the way the academy is organized, you're organized into squads within your company. But my squad, the senior, the college senior, the first class who was in charge of it was Mike Martin, who went on to become a platoon commander with me at SEAL Team 1. The second class was Walter Allman, who's extraordinary frogman who's done some amazing things. And then in the plebes within our small little table of, you know, 8-10 people that we sat at, the plebes were myself and Eric Ulrich, who went on to become a frogman, and another guy named Dave Wright, who went on to try it and go to Buds as a lateral transfer. So like even within my little community, we had this real like horsepower squad.
That's impressive. I mean, it's hard to get one guy out of the same company to, you know, more than one, you know, out of the same company. Cause there's in our time, did you have 36 companies back then?
We did.
Yeah. So in our time, there's 36 companies, and then, you know, there weren't 36 billets, you know, there was like 18, 19 billets. And if you had more than one per company, it was strange.
So imagine a year of your life sitting at a table eating square meals with four other guys who would go on to become SEALs. Like it has a profound influence in your life. And then when I remember doing the summer training with you, and you brought a bunch of other enlisted SEALs, guys like Instructor Disney came and you put us through some Hoo-Yah high-speed training. I think all those experiences stuck with me when I went back to Santa Cruz. And then as my friends went, and you know, most of them are out now, or they're just getting out now if they had a full 20-year career in the teams. So guys like, you know, as Eric Ulrich and Brian Valenza and these other great frogmen who I had trained with in prepping for this experience, as they were then getting SEAL billets and rotating out to California, a lot of them ended up stopping in Santa Cruz on their way out to Coronado to visit my dad and I, and we do workouts. I remember taking those guys to the first CrossFit gym that opened in Santa Cruz on their way down to Buds.
Yeah, that's old school. That is old school now. Yeah.
And so as I saw my friends from the academy and I watched them go through their process, I still continued to have a desire to serve. When I finished school at UC Santa Cruz, I decided, like, I'm going to try and go back in through the officer candidate school route. And as you know, there's about 10 billets a year for OCS to go. And it's a little different than the academy. It's a little different than ROTC in the sense that you apply for an OCS billet as a SEAL billet. So you say like, hey, I want to go be a SEAL. You get thrown in the pile with all of the other people across the country who went to college on their own and want to be SEALs. And they pick about 10 of them.
Yeah. And you're also competing with guys that are already SEALs that are with a college degree that want to go OCS. So it's competitive. Right. I mean, to get one of those slots is really challenging.
Yeah. And truth be told, this is kind of the fulcrum point of my story. Truth be told, the first time I put in my package around, they passed on me. They're like, well, this guy was at the academy. He like, we're not really that sure, you know, like he had his shot to go to Buds, you know? So they kind of passed, and I was kind of put in the, like, the limbo pile. And at that time I was competing professionally in ocean racing. So run, swim, runs and long paddles and stuff like that. And I was also competing on this American Surf Racing series where I was doing big wave surfing and all this stuff. And but the crazy part was that in order to be eligible for some of those competitions, you had to be an active lifeguard. So I was an active ocean lifeguard. And in Santa Cruz, being an ocean lifeguard is pretty serious because have like a lot of big waves. It's like Hawaii. The ocean lifeguards there are really respected. Same with us. Sure. And there was an incident that happened where I think you've been to Santa Cruz, right? You know, yeah. the bay there with the boardwalk, there's this pier that goes out into the ocean about a mile out. And when I was lifeguarding, a car actually drove off the wharf, off the end of the pier. And I ran up there with a bunch of other lifeguards and we started free diving on there. And it was a long story, but there was a rescue that went down. And, you know, most of the lifeguards, you know, couldn't make it down because it's, you know, deep and dark and cold and all that stuff. And me and another lifeguard named Ryan Buell were able to kind of get there in the car and like rip on the guy and pull him. And eventually, along with a couple divers, we were able to kind of get this guy out of the car after about 11 minutes. It was a big deal. When I dove in the water the first time, you know, the car was on its back like a turtle and the roof was kind of crushed. So I think I actually like ripped the guy's shoulder out, like trying to yank him out of the car at one point. But it was a big deal. Those of us who were involved in the rescue got a key to the city and all of this stuff. And so I included that kind of write-up article in my officer package. And the community manager, the detailer at the time, was a guy named Commander Carlson, Tom Carlson. And I guess he was in Santa Cruz with his wife a few months thereafter. And he was there on the wharf getting clam chowder or something. And he saw a plaque that was dedicated to the rescue. And the story was kind of familiar to him. And, you know, I think after reconsidering it, they said, you know what, we're going to give this guy another shot. Anybody who can like drop down the middle of the ocean, rip a guy out of a car, like deserves a second chance. And they opened up another billet that year. Next thing I knew, I was on my way to Bud's.
Well, that's interesting. it really is amazing the little things that happen sometimes that open up someone's world. And that's a hell of a story. How deep was that?
I think, you know, I don't really know. I've gone back a couple times and done some free dives on. I think it was about 30 feet realistically. But you know, in Santa Cruz, the water is like, you know, the visibility is not good. The sedimentation is high. I remember the first drop that I did on the car, I couldn't even find it. Yeah. Eventually I had to listen. There was like a fan belt still whirling or something. So eventually I just kind of listened and like wormed my way to the car. So I think my first couple of free dives were pretty impressive. By the end, like, you know, they were like 35 seconds, you know.
Wow, that is impressive.
Well, I cut the seatbelt with a knife and all this stuff. Like, we worked hard to get that guy out.
Man, that's a hell of a story. So you got your chance. How was your OCS experience compared to your 2 years at the academy? How was that?
Process? I mean, OCS was not a challenge for me because I'd already spent a year as a plebe and then a year as a youngster at the academy. And now I was like thrown in with, what's the pejorative term? They say 13 week wonders
right? 13 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So it was really easy. So I really excelled at officer candidate school. I graduated number one in my class there. Oh, I was the regimental commander. And that's based on a combination of physical, academic, military skills. So I was able to, because I had this great experience from the academy, I was able to really kind of lead from the front at the officer candidate school. In the weird, funny way that life works, I remember sitting there at the tables during officer candidate school at one point and looking across, and I saw another guy who was in the class of 99, a guy named Aaron Smith, who was a basketball player who I had known really well, and he had ended up leaving the academy and then came back in through OCS just like me. And so you just never know.
Yeah. You know what? There's so many ways to go. Like you said earlier, there's so many ways to serve, you know, whether that's the multiple options for officers or it's the enlisted route. And then you can even go officer from the enlisted route. I mean, there's so many ways to serve. So, okay. So now we're at Bud's. All right. And so your life has probably prepared you pretty well for what you're about to endure. Where did you feel like you were in the class, with your years of experience in the water and, you know, hard training and all that?
Yeah. I felt very strong and very prepared going in. I had had so many mentors and friends who had helped condition me. I was living in a house with several other SEALs who had been through. So I felt I moved down to San Diego prior to starting training, and so I had a couple guys to kind of guide me and get me ready and prepared. And I felt as prepared as you can be going in. I think I did quite well. The water stuff, you want to be good at everything, but if you're really good at something, there's an advantage to that as well, because sure. It helps alleviate pressure. Sure. Right. So
at least for that event. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so then, I think I won pretty much every swim in Buds, even if I was, helping a guy out. Right? So where for other people, a 2 mile ocean swim was a stressful evolution. For me, sure. That was a time to relax. Right. Like sure. I knew I would be okay. I've seen great runners take the same approach. Like,
absolutely.
And they know that, okay, I'm going to be fine. And anything you can do, it's such a high pressure environment, anything you can do to ratchet back the pressure and take a moment that's, I don't want to call it 2 mile ocean swim recovery, but closer to recovery than full throttle gives you an advantage.
There is a time and place to go full throttle and bring your A game, but there are some events that you are still going to crush the standard, even with a, pull back a little bit and conserve some energy, because it's a marathon, right? I mean, that right. One event is one of several events of the day that you have to endure and exceed the standard. So that philosophy works. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be both all in and strategic simultaneously.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And also you have to, and I think this translates well to life, both in the teams and out of the teams, right? You have to think about the long-term longevity of what you're doing, right? There is a time to be unrestrained, right? Like
sure. In
Hell Week when you just let it all go, you just let it all hang out, but you also have to be conscious of injury prevention. And I think even within the SEAL community, where we go really, really hard, we've gotten much smarter about how we do really, really hard things. Instead of breaking guys, with bad static line jumps, right? We move everybody to free fall so we save their knees, right? We think about like long-term compression injuries, right?
Sure.
And there are ways to be just as hard, but also smarter. And I think that's also, injury prevention is critical in Buds as well.
Oh yeah. And licking your wounds at the end of the day, because you're going to get them. Those little scratches turn into infections that can just stop you in your tracks. Just all the little things, a little bump turns into a bruise that turns into swelling that now your joint doesn't work correctly, because everything's jammed up. So yeah. So,
so Buds was a great experience for me. I have to say, it was extraordinary. I had incredible. Everybody thinks they have incredible classmates. I truly had incredible classmates.
What Buds class was that?
So I was 237. And there's a lot of well-known people that came out of that Buds class. We were, because of the nature of the timing of our class, right? We were in first phase on 9/11. I remember that day pretty well. I just finished 2 mile ocean swim.
Wow.
And walked into the first phase classroom. They told us what happened. And and I think that was an inflection point, not just for me, but for the SEAL teams as well. And we moved to a wartime posture after that.
Yeah, things changed that day. I mean, I was all pre 9/11, and you could spend 20 years in the SEAL teams and never see a combat situation, right? Whereas after 9/11, it was for the foreseeable future, we're going to spend probably 20 years and not see peace. And we're about there, right? We're almost there.
Yeah. We're there. We're there. It's almost 20 years. Exactly. Yeah. Now we got guys for the first time showing up to Buds who were born after September 11th. If that doesn't make you feel.
I don't need to hear that. I don't need to hear that. That's impressive. We've made it quite a long ways. I'm not sure where this went. So you are what, 40, in your 40s now?
Yep.
In your 40s? How is that? How is that going for you as far as,
it's unbelievable.
Post-tactical world and, You know, how you feel?
I feel great. You know, so my transition, I did 5.5, almost 6 years on active duty. And then I transitioned to graduate school. So then I spent my 30th birthday in graduate school.
Not just any graduate school. Go ahead. Tell us where you went.
We like to say Harvard, you know, we don't say it at all. You know, that school by the Charles River.
Yeah. Postgrad.
Right.
Yeah. Up in Boston.
In Boston. Right. So I went to graduate school at Harvard. I studied public policy, international relations, emphasis on national security because of my background. And that was my kind of transition to the civilian world. But I stayed in the reserves as well. So I had a 2-year break in service while I was in graduate school so I could fully focus on graduate school. And then I stayed in the reserves, which was a really outstanding decision because it really allowed me to stay close and contribute to my community. A lot of people actually don't even realize that there are SEAL reserves out there.
Oh yeah.
But it is, for me, post-active duty, an extraordinary way to stay connected to our community and to continue to serve.
Yeah, especially what you're doing. So let's tell everybody, like, you've transitioned out of the SEAL world now. And how was that transition first? Getting out and doing something else. How was that? Because a lot of us have a hard time making that transition. But if you keep yourself busy, it can help.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the life lessons that you come out of the SEAL community with is constant motion. All right, always putting one foot forward. Sometimes you can't think all the way down the road, but in Hell Week, we learn like, hey, sometimes you just got to get to the next meal. Sometimes you got to just take the next step, right? Yeah. But either way, you keep moving, you keep going, right?
And that's a really good lesson. That's
right.
That's powerful. Yeah, I like that.
So for me, I ended up in graduate school, which was actually an excellent transition. And, you know, if we scale back for a second, to the veterans world in general, a lot of veterans do struggle both from our community and from the conventional side. But I think any kind of post-service education is a really good soft landing for getting off active duty. There's a couple of reasons for that. One of the biggest is your social networks. When we're on active duty, a lot of our influences and the people we know are all in the military as well. So you leave that and it can be isolated and lonely. And one of the keys to success in the civilian world is actually developing new social networks and relationships of people who can help you on the civilian side.
Sure.
And so graduate school, especially a place like Harvard, is a phenomenal place to do that. So that was really positive for me. And then the other thing you do is, and we know this in the teams, like you keep growing and you keep evolving, right? And again, picking up a new skill or a new education was really fundamental to that. And I found myself, this happened while I was in graduate school. You know, when I was a hippie kid in Santa Cruz, we didn't have a TV. So I didn't watch TV or anything like that. But I had a friend who was working at a television network who offered me an opportunity to be a war correspondent at this new, he's like, well, Kaj knows about war. He's a SEAL. Like, I think he'd be great. So I actually did my first assignment in Afghanistan. I did a 13-part documentary series, and it was pretty successful for this network called Current TV. And then I continued to work as a correspondent to help pay for graduate school. And so I did that first summer in Afghanistan, Christmas in back in Afghanistan, spring break Cambodia, the next summer in Somalia, all reporting on different conflict zones around the world.
Yeah, I've seen some of those videos. They're phenomenal. I mean, very well done. Now I saw some for Vice as well.
Yep. So on the civilian side, my trajectory was that I went from this little obscure network, Current TV, doing a lot of conflict zone reporting. And then I was actually poached by CNN. So I was a war correspondent for CNN for several years. And then after CNN, I went to Vice and I hosted as a correspondent their HBO show, which was kind of their flagship series for several years. And there's And that put me kind of in this media lens. And at the same time, simultaneously, I was able to operate as a reserve officer in the SEAL teams attached to SOCOM. And nice. It was a funny hybrid. You know, I keep a real church and state separation between my media work and my military work.
Sure.
But that's been the last decade for me.
I would imagine as a wartime correspondent, you know, I've seen some of those shows you've done and you are carrying, right? I see you carrying weapons too.
Yeah.
and a couple of, maybe it was the one in Africa. I can't remember which
Nigeria.
One.
Nigeria.
Yeah.
Well, when I was in Northern Nigeria, so for people who don't know, there's this conflict that's happening up in Northern Nigeria. And there's a group called Boko Haram, which is actually affiliated with ISIS. They're most famous for kidnapping those 300 schoolgirls. Yep. And the Nigerian government had banned journalists from going there. In fact, they arrested two Al Jazeera journalists who tried to sneak in and cover the conflict up there. But I was able to sneak in with a group of PMCs that I knew, private military contractors, South African mercenaries in civilian speak. And, but I was, I mean, you know, it's one thing to be in a war zone with a SEAL platoon.
Yeah.
You got 16 pipe hitters, right?
With you got comms AWs. With air assets.
Yeah. You got JTACs calling in, you know, C-130 Spectre gunships. You know, you got everything you need. It is another thing to be out there by yourself in Northern Nigeria with, you know, a little Canon 5D. So I was way, way out on the fringe of the hinterland there, like at one point kind of living in the trenches with the Nigerian army. And so, you know, our tents would get mortared every night and by the Boko Haram guys and all that stuff. So that was as front line as it gets. And that war is old school. I'm talking literally trench warfare. So the Nigerian guys live in the trench. They shoot it at the Boko guys. About 1,000 meters away who are holed up in a school. That was every night for 6 weeks.
Wow. Wow. That is beyond exciting.
Yeah.
any crazy moments that you want to share about any of those journeys that just made you, maybe thankful for some of your previous training, or you just got out of there purely out of luck? Any situations like that?
I think that it's all, you know, a combination of luck and skill, right? And in fact, when you're there, you say it's better to be lucky than good. But, I think Northern Nigeria is a great example. I've done stuff from war zones around the world, but particularly in Africa and places like Mogadishu and Maiduguri on the west coast of Africa, or in Mali or in Mauritania. I don't know how all these M names keep coming up, but
there's a lot of them in Africa. Yeah.
These are some of the toughest environments in the world. And of course, understanding the military component matters. Of course, understanding, being able to pick up an AK-47 is, I think, really important, right? And understanding, you know, how combat works and to a degree, at least that kind of combat. That's really important. I do think it helps keep you safe. But the stuff that matters most is the human-to-human connection. For me, the ability to, one, talk to soldiers, because I've walked a mile in their boots, and to really understand what they're going through. And that's really helped my journalism and just my situational awareness in war zones. And then just to talk to people in general. Like, you know, one of the things when I traded my gun for a camera and started going into war zones to document what was happening to people, it allowed me in some ways the opportunity to see the other side. So, you know, I've even gone so far I interviewed some of the commanders of some of the Boko Haram guys who had captured some of those women, right? That was an interesting experience for me because in some ways I was sitting 3 feet across from the enemy.
Yeah.
And one part of me wanted to like snatch the life out of those guys right there in this, you know, secret clandestine meeting. But another part of me had to say like, okay, this is an opportunity to learn right? And people act for a reason, and we need to understand our enemy, and we need to even approach that with empathy sometimes.
Sure, sure.
For how they got in that situation. Like, as we know, you know, some of those, so, you know, some of these guys are 16-year-old kids, and they get, they grew up in impoverished circumstances without education, and they get recruited into a radical ideology. So for me, one of the, I don't know if this exactly answers your question, but one of the hardest transitions, but what I think is one of the most important transitions, is being able to see both sides of a conflict.
No, that is a skill that is hard to teach. You know, that's really a genuine blessing to be able to go into those situations with being able to do that. So that's pretty incredible. So what are you doing now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for the first time, the main thing that I'm doing is, now I create and host original documentary series. So I work in media, I just completed a year and a half long project, which is a new original series, that's going to be on one of the big streaming outlets. You could probably guess which one.
Right. One I've been watching a lot during this quarantine. Yeah.
They're doing really well right now. Yeah. Can you say Tiger King? Anyways, yeah. I have a new series that hasn't been, you watch that?
No, I refuse.
I may or may not have just broken down and bought the Tiger King, you know? I just finished a six one-hour multi-part documentary series for one of the big streaming outlets, and that's on narco trafficking. One of the things I've been covering a lot over the last couple of years is narco trafficking, chasing drug dealers around the world, places like Kenya, Colombia, Central America, even Afghanistan. We were in Burma for this series. It's really an amazing global series about the economics of narco trafficking. So that was a massive project I just finished up. And then I got a couple more in the pipe after that.
Man, that's really nice.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So now I know you also have a, is it one of the earlier CrossFit gyms in Santa Monica?
Yeah. So I own CrossFit Santa Monica with another Frogman.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, we started it as a passion project because, you know, fitness and CrossFit started in my hometown. I went to the original gym we started as kind of a passion project because CrossFit helped us so much with our training and our physical fitness. But, it, you know, it actually morphed into this amazing thing where we're like, you know, we had a woman lose, you know, 120 pounds at the gym. We've had people meet and get married. It's turned into this great community where we get to share, like, just like you shared with me, and I'm still doing your workouts. I did one this morning. Just like you shared with me the gift of, like, physical fitness and great workouts, I'm out now able to do that to the bigger community here in LA.
That's
and it's
awesome.
Been awesome.
Yeah, no, I love the communities that are built around that. And it's funny because, you know, you're right. They tend to become each other's social group, and, you know, there's this mutual respect that occurs. And then some of my favorite stories are the 100-plus pound weight losses. You know, I could care less somebody goes from 10 pull-ups to 20 pull-ups. That's easy, you know. But if someone could drop 100 pounds or more, that is just life-changing for that person. Yeah,
life-changing. It's amazing. And, you know, you said one of the, you know, what's hard about getting out of the military, I told you the good stuff. The hard stuff is you lose this instant community and camaraderie sometimes of working out, like, you know, you know, doing a work, a monster mash at the team on a Friday morning and competing against, you know, 130 other hard chargers, hoo-yahs, and just like letting it all hang out, throwing on some body armor and like running around Coronado, like that instantly goes away. So one of the reasons we started this facility was to kind of recreate that.
Absolutely.
And,
I did the exact same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my members from the gym is actually coming over today. He specifically requested we do a Frogman Friday workout. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to keep the tradition alive.
Nice. Yeah. We used to do we still do Payday PT. You ever do that one?
Yeah.
whenever the 1st or the 15th occurred, it was a payday PT, and you're going to earn it.
Better earn it.
You're going to earn it that day. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been great. So it's been great to be multifaceted in the civilian world, to be able to balance my, you know, military responsibilities, my media work in the private sector, and then to have this great outlet for physical fitness and for staying alive.
Yeah, that's a great balance, 100%. So what's next for Kaj? What do you see, you know, 5 years as you come closer to 50 years old, like me?
Yeah. Well, I mean, most importantly, I expect you out here for the premiere of Top Gun 2 with me.
it was a life-changing moment. So
That's right.
I will do that. You give me an invite somehow, I'll do it. 100%.
Look, I've been lucky enough through that constant motion. Well, first of all, the caveat, I don't know what's next for any of us because we are living in crazy times, right?
Good point. If anybody would have told me, I'd have been, watching Netflix all month and, learning about a Tiger King. I would not have believed them. So.
Yeah. Although what I will say is, you know, in my experience around the world, and specifically in war zones and in conflict zones around the world, that I have seen people in incredibly arduous circumstances adapt and not only just survive, but thrive. And the adaptability of the human condition is extraordinary. And I expect to see that with this crisis as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's going to be a shining point to this at some point. And it may change business, how we do it. You know, I mean, you and I are able to speak via Zoom. Though this isn't not like a part of my paid programming or anything, but it is content, you know, and we're making content and it's very useful and people will find out more about us and hear about more shows. So it is, you know, there are ways to come out of this a lot stronger and a lot better than we did business before. 100%.
Yeah. And you gotta be dynamic and you gotta be flexible. And, you know, for me, in times of uncertainty, I often fall back on the principles that we learned through our training and, you know, improvise, adapt, overcome. That's what we're doing. We're doing that with my CrossFit business. I'm doing that in media, right? We're improvising, we're adapting, and then this too, we shall all overcome, which is
absolutely. And like you said earlier, you know, sometimes you just got to take one step forward, right? Or if you can, make it to the next meal, right? And next thing you know, this is going to be over with, and we're 10 times stronger than we thought we were going into it.
Yeah, just like training, nobody ever got faster by, just running at a 15-minute mile pace, by just shuffling along at a 15-minute mile pace, right? Yeah. Even in fitness, you know, we train ourselves sometimes to the point of failure in order to break down that muscle tissue and grow stronger in the end. And I think that's what we have to do during this time period as well. So for me, what that looks like 5 years over the horizon is, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have this really interesting career in media. And so I'm going to continue to put out content and ideas that I think matter. Often, you know, I'm not traveling too much overseas right now, but, you know, one of the things I do well is I go to these dark corners of the world, and I help shine a light on issues. And I continue to do more of that in the future.
Well, wonderful mission. Wonderful mission. I appreciate it, what you do, but also appreciate what, you know, for just giving me some time. Like I said, I've been wanting to have you on here for a while just to kind of share your journey. Because, you know, part of this is, one, making your story relatable to everybody. You know, you're just a surfer kid that, you know, just happened to find a path that, you know, brought you this way, and, you know, it's doable. And I think a lot of your successes largely comes to, you know, you almost have to see it to believe it, right? And so you met a lot of people along your journey that had been there, that had done that. And it just, you know, you going to Bud's was just an outcome of your journey that got you to where you're going to be anyway. You just had to endure this. It wasn't one of these impossible events that, you know, that a lot of people go into thinking, you know, no one ever graduates this. How am I going to graduate? You know, you can't go into that training like that. You got to think of this as you are going to thrive and you are going to, you know, kick some butt and whatever that journey is. So I appreciate, you telling your story. Any last words for the group? Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, well, I'm on all the socials. You know, you can, if you want to see some of my work, I actually been during this pandemic taking the time to update my website, which is kajlarson.com. I tend to share a lot of content on the gram. I think that's what the kids are calling it these days, you know? So that's at Kaj Larson. So I'm on all the social channels. I'm super accessible. Like, you people reach out to me all the time looking for, sort of advice and guidance on the SEAL community and on journalism. And, that always makes me really happy that I can, share some of what I've learned with other people. So yeah, far and away, just hit me up. And
yeah, I'll put all your information in the description below. So just everybody, if you're still watching, just check out the description below and you'll get all the links right to where Kaj is. So you can see what he's doing and ask him questions if you prefer. So Kaj, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Good to see you again. Looking sharp. Looking fit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I gotta say, thanks for everything you've done for me, Stu. And, even hitting one of your old, pyramid workouts this morning, like that's why I'm feeling young and strong now. You know,
I did a pyramid yesterday with my son. So, they're still happening.
I love it.
We're making PT pyramids great again.
I love it.
All right. We'll see you, Kaj. Take care.
Good to see you, brother.
All right.